Shit That Scares Us, a podcast about scary stuff.
Oh, Jesus Christ. My God, it's happening. This is the very last episode of Shit That Scares Us. I just want to say thank you to my mom.
And God.
And God. And all of the witches, deceased, living, all the magical entities.
Those above and so below.
Agreed.
I don't know what the fuck to do, eh? I'm currently sitting here. It's very weird.
It is weird.
Yeah, this is our last episode. Oh my God.
So grateful that if you are listening, that you have listened and are listening, you're a winner. You're a real star. This has been such a fun experience and taught us both a lot. She's a trickster. TikTok has taken over every part of my life. I cannot get away from it.
Jesus Christ.
But I feel like both of us have gotten so much out of this experience and it's been so fun. And I mean, you've done lots of creative things and I've done creative things and it's been such a great outlet. Yeah, it has been really good. And now we're moving on in life. But before we do that, we have stories because it's Halloween week, baby.
Halloween. Yeah, motherfucker.
This is our favorite month of the year and it's almost over in like a week. I can't believe it.
I literally live for this single time of the year. That is it. I am on autopilot every other minute of the year except for October 1st to October 31st.
Agreed. This is the best month of the year. Make it count, y'all, if you're out there. Spooky season is now. Now. And on that note, we have some stories for you today, both of which are really sad and sort of depressing, but also true crime. We're back.
Thought it'd be good to go up with a bang. A little bit of mass murder.
Why not? Mass murder. Oh, man. Mass murder do be happening, though. And today it be happening in Iowa. We're going to Iowa to begin with. You may have heard this.
I'm not surprised.
You may have heard the story at all, but I really hope you haven't. And if you have, saddle up, y'all, because we're not only are we going to Iowa to hear about a tragic story of a slain family in the early 1900s, but we are also going to one of the most haunted locations in the United States, apparently, as well.
Jesus Christ.
Right, let me begin. Are we ready?
I'm ready. I'm strapped in. So, locked and loaded.
I really apologize if I have pronounced this place wrong. I've looked it up. I've listened to YouTube clips. And this is how I'm pronouncing it. But today I am going to tell you the story of the Villisca Axe murders in Iowa. So, on June 9th, 1912, and the early morning of June 10th in 1912, the town of Villisca, Iowa, in the United States, faced a massive, massive tragedy. The tragedy happened in a family home. And the victims of the tragedy were the six members of the Moore family, and two of their guests who were found bludgeoned to death inside the Moore residence. All of the eight victims, including six of them who were children, had severe head wounds from an axe. So the Moore family consisted of the parents, Josiah B., who was 43, and Sarah, maiden name Montgomery, I believe, 39, and their four children, Herman, Mary Catherine, Arthur Boyd, and Paul Vernon. Now, the Moores were an affluent family and well-known and liked within their community, which is important when we consider how this case ends. So on June 9th in 1912, Mary Catherine Moore invited Ina May and Lena Gertrude Stillinger to spend the night at the Moore residence. That evening, the visiting girls and the Moore family attended the Presbyterian church in their town where they participated in the Children's Day program, which Sarah had coordinated. After the program ended at around 9:30 p.m., the Moores and the Stillinger sisters walked back to the Moores household, and they arrived apparently between 9:45 and 10 p.m. The next day, at 7 a.m., Mary Peckham, the Moores' neighbor, became really concerned after the Moores failed to emerge from their house to do the chores that they would often do in the morning. So seeing that they had not emerged, she went and she knocked on their door. Nobody answered. And being so concerned for her neighbors, she tried to open the door, but discovered that it was locked. Mary then went to the Moore's chicken coop and let them out. And after this, she called Ross Moore, Josiah's brother. Ross comes over. And again, like Mary, he receives no response when he knocks on the door. So using a copy of the house's skeleton key, he unlocks the door. While Peckham stood on the porch, Mary Peckham stood on the porch, Ross entered the parlor into the house, opened the guest bedroom door, and inside he found Ina and Lena Stillinger's bodies on the bed. Immediately, Moore tells Mary to call Henry or Hank Horton, and Hank Horton is the town's primary peace officer. So Hank arrives, and shortly after he begins to search the house. And as he searches the house, he finds that the entire Moore family and the two Stillinger girls had been bludgeoned to death. 8 people. The murder weapon was an axe belonging to Josiah, and it's found in the guest room where the Stillinger sisters were found. Now, upon an investigation, doctors concluded that the murders had been taken place between midnight and about 5 a.m. And there were these circulating sort of rumors that upstairs in the attic, 2 cigarette butts were found that people say suggested that the killers waited for the family to get home. But according to an official tour, there weren't any cigarette butts found. So there is a bit of circulating information that isn't guaranteed to be true, but sort of lives as connected to the story. The killers began... Killer or killers began in the master bedroom where Josiah and Sarah Moore were sleeping. Josiah received more blows than any other victim in the house. And they say that his face had been attacked so much to such a severe extent that his eyes were missing in the end. The killer or killers used the blade of the axe on Josiah while they used the blunt end on the rest of the victims in the house. Herman, Mary Catherine, Arthur, and Paul were next bludgeoned in the head in the same manner as their parents. And also something of note is that they found like slice marks on the roofs of these rooms, which would suggest that the killer was quite tall because the slice was made from the swing of the axe going backwards, I believe. After Herman, Mary, Arthur, and Paul were killed, apparently the murderer returned to the master bedroom to inflict more blows on the elder Moores. And then they moved downstairs to the guest bedroom and killed Ina and Lena. Apparently, afterwards, this is such a strange fact, a 4-pound slab of bacon was taken out of an icebox, which is like, I suppose, what we would know now as a freezer, but like the less advanced equivalent, and it was laid next to the axe. Investigators also found untouched food, bloody water during the search, and they believed that all of the victims, this is so sad, except for Lena Stillinger, had been asleep when murdered. They believe that she was awake and tried to fight back against her attacker because of the way that she was found, the position in which she was found, and the fact that she had defensive wounds on her arms, which is often a sign that things haven't gone as easily for the killer. It was also speculated that Lena was sexually assaulted or that the killer attempted to sexually assault her. There have been and are a large number of suspects that were officially investigated and continue to be referenced as possible perpetrators after this terrible, terrible act, some of which include a man named Reverend George Kelly. Kelly was an English-born traveling minister who was in town on the night of the murders, and he struggled with traumatic events as a child, but as an adult, was found to have preyed on young women and girls in a number of different ways. Kelly actually confessed to the murders in court, but the jury didn't believe his confession. He was charged, but he was later acquitted, so he wasn't obviously a reliable suspect. There was a man named Frank F. Jones, who was a resident of the town and an Iowa state senator. He was a suspect, was also acquitted. There was a man named William Mansfield, who ended up having an alibi, but was also a suspect. And there were plenty more suspects. You can look them all up online. They're all on like the Wikipedia page. So there was someone named Loving Mitchell, Paul Mueller, and Henry Lee Moore, who was of no relation to the family. But yeah, the Reverend was tried twice for the murder. But the first trial ended in a hung jury, and the second, he was acquitted. And All other suspects in the investigation were also exonerated. And to this day, there is still no convicted suspect, and the motive also is completely unknown. The house is said to be one of the most haunted places in the United States, and if that story initially wasn't strange and horrible enough, there's more to the house and how it lives on now. So it was bought in 1994, refurbished to look exactly like its like first state in which the Moore family lived there. And experiences to stay in the house became bookable. It was apparently $428 a night, and the new owner allowed guests to stay overnight in the house. Because of how many paranormal experiences people have said have happened there, it is one of the most regularly visited sites for ghost hunters in the States. One of which was a man who visited the Axe Murder House in Iowa and was rushed afterwards to a nearby hospital when he was found with a self-inflicted stab wound to his chest. He was a paranormal investigator, and his name was Stephen Lawson Jr. of Wisconsin. He arrived apparently with a group of friends because they were doing like a recreational sort of paranormal investigation. And according to a sheriff from Montgomery County, the man Lawson was alone in the northwest bedroom and the rest of his friends were outside. And then he called for help on their mobile two-way radios. And then his companions found him stabbed in the chest with apparently self-inflicted wounds. They called 911. And he was taken to a nearby hospital before being helicoptered onwards to a medical center. Not only was there a tragic murdering in the house of an entire family, like an entire family just taken out. And not only that, but like two young girls who had been visiting them just for the night. But to this day, there are still weird kind of happenings in the house. And I haven't been able to find the owner's like commentary on what happened to the man, the paranormal investigator. But that was not that long ago. I believe. So it's just like a crazy, sad, strange place. And if you actually Google the Axe Murder House, there's pictures of like the whole outside and the interior up as well. So you can like click through the pictures of the house. And that is a very brief summary of the Axe Murder House in Iowa, which is so sad.
That's crazy that you actually... that you picked that, because I kid you not, I watched some shit literally a couple days ago.
Really? On this?
On this.
That's so crazy. Actually, I love it.
So yeah, it's pretty fucked up. The guy was actually hidden in their attic.
They said that there were like cigarette butts, but then the official tour goes on to say that there were no cigarette butts in there and that they can't be sure that he was hiding in the attic. But like that story doesn't just come from nowhere, right?
Yeah. So I'm gonna do a mini shout out here.
Yeah.
If you guys, it's a really good paranormal investigation team that I stumbled across on YouTube. They are called Charm City Paranormal. Cool. They did an investigation on this house, talked to the guy that actually stabbed himself in the chest. And some what of the stuff say? That they capture is fucked up. Like, it's very, lots of voice phenomenons, lots of creaks. A piano played out of nowhere when no one was in the house.
Did the guy say anything about what happened? Was it like a psychosis basically, thing? Or?
He was basically like, saying that, you know, he just felt like he went out off, like he didn't have control,
right?
Like and whether or not this is true, this is totally speculation, but the guys that were doing the investigation when they interviewed him were, you know, speculating maybe that this axe murder killer potentially possessed him and influenced him to stab himself, which I mean I take with a grain of salt, but like
of course, but like that the way that in which like places with such a tragic past can influence people who are already you know that he was possessed in one way or another, right? Whether it was real or it was the history of the house and his own preconceived ideas of what the place was going to be like, and then his own life and experiences. Possessed him in one way or another. Yeah.
It's such a crazy story. It's fully tragic. But the guy yeah, apparently hid in the attic. And yeah, snuck out when everyone was asleep. And yes, those marks on the wall are because he was using the axe back to front.
You know what's I find strange, though, the fact that, like, there was that mention of how Josiah had the force of the damage, like the blade damage, and everybody else didn't. So that, to me, sounds like he's, I mean, I don't know anything about, I'm not a paranormal or, you know, an investigator of any capacity, but that would say to me that there was more of like a hatred or aggression towards him, Josiah, instead of the rest of them.
No, definitely. Like the way that the differences between each of the kills and, you know, the varying degrees of violence definitely would suggest that, yeah, he definitely had it out for. But yeah, it's fucked. Mm. I think also with the bacon, I don't know if this is true as well, but he apparently made himself a sandwich.
What the fuck?
Yeah. So he killed in family, sat down, made himself a sandwich or some type of meal, and then fucked off, basically.
It was also that thing of, I don't know how true, one of the suspects was said to be like someone who they assumed was a serial killer operating on a railway network, and that the house was near railway lines as well, which yeah, I thought there was kind of interesting.
There were varying different theories of, you know, who it could be. I mean... Mm. I don't know if we'll ever really know, you know, DNA evidence and stuff like wasn't around at the time. But I highly recommend if you guys loved listening to this story, because I fucking loved it. This is great.
I thought I was going to get you with this one. But I didn't. You know it all.
I literally do nothing in my spare time apart from like watch really fucked up shit. But no, this is a really good story. And if you want more context to it or even, you know, a bit more of a spooky edge, I highly recommend going and watching the investigation by Charm City Paranormal, because fuck me, it had me messed up.
Amazing. I'm so going to watch it now.
That was amazing. Yeah, no, it is definitely one of the... coldest mass murders that I mean I've ever read about. It's so fucked up, so great choice.
Yeah, and also just that house itself, spooky as
fuck. Oh right, yeah, no, even the images of it, like oh god, it does set something off in your like little animal brain, and you know,
like run.
The total fight or flight. It's very much run the fuck away.
Wow, so that was that, and now we move on to another.
Yeah, so another
mass murder. Fuck, what is happening today?
Honestly, I don't know. more mass murder for you on the way. So yeah, this next story is about a family in California, in Kitty, California, and let's kick off.
Let's go.
It's been 14 years after a teenage girl came home to find her family brutally murdered. The Kitty murders took place from the 11th to the 12th of April in 1981 in Kitty, California. The victims were Sue Sharp, 36 years old, her daughter Tina Louise Sharp, 12 years old, and son John Stephen Sharp, 15, and John's friend Dana Hall Wingate, who was 17. The murders took place in house number 28 of the Kitty Resort. The bodies of Sue, John and Dana were found on the morning of April 12th by Sheila, her 14-year-old daughter, who had been sleeping at a friend's house. Sue's two younger sons, Rick, who was 10, and Greg, 5, as well as their friends, Justin Smart, were also in the house, but were unharmed. Tina was missing from the scene. Tina would remain a missing person until April 1984. When her skull and several other bones were recovered at Camp 18, 50 miles away in Butte County. The skull was recovered after an anonymous tip was called in. What was even more dubious is that the call took place on the third anniversary of the murders, and the caller identified the skull as Tina's. The morning of April 12th at 7 a.m, Sheila returned to Cabin 28 and discovered the dead bodies of Sue, John, and Dana in the house's living room. All three bodies had been bound with medical tape and electrical cords. Tina was absent from the home, while the three younger children, Rick, Greg, and Justin, were unharmed in the adjacent bedroom. The murders of Sue, John, and Dana were notably vicious. They had been stabbed and bludgeoned to death. so violently that one of the bloody knives recovered at the crime scene had been bent at a 30-degree angle. The blood splatter evidence from inside the house indicated that the murders of Sue, John, and Dana had all taken place in the living room. Sue Sharp was discovered lying on her side near the living room sofa, stripped from the waist down and gagged with a blue bandana. She had been stabbed in the chest as well as through the throat, the wound going through her larynx and nicking her spine, and on the side of her head was an imprint matching the butt of a Daisy 880 Powerline BB pellet rifle. John's throat had been slashed, and Dana had multiple head injuries and had been manually strangled to death. Both John and Dana suffered blunt force trauma to their heads with a hammer, or hammers. Autopsies determined that Sue and John died from the knife wounds and blunt force trauma, and Dana had died by asphyxiation. Sheila had spent the night with the Seabolt family. They heard no commotion during the night, though a couple living nearby Cabin 28 in Cabin 16 was awakened at 1:15 in the morning by the sound of muffled screaming. Tina's jacket, shoes, and toolbox containing various tools were missing from the house, which showed no indication of forced entry. The house's telephone had been taken off the hook and the cord cut from the outlet, and the drapes were closed. Martin Smart, a neighbor and main suspect, claimed that a claw hammer had inexplicably gone missing from his home. Plumas County Sheriff Sylvester Thomas, who presided over the case, later stated that Martin had provided endless clues in the case that seemed to throw the suspicion away from him. In addition to interviewing the Smarts, detectives interviewed numerous other locals and neighbors, several including members of the Seabolt family, who recalled seeing a green van parked around the Sharps' cabin at 9 p.m. Justin, according to the police, gave conflicting stories of the evening, including that he had dreamed details of the murders, though he later claimed to have actually witnessed them. In his later account of the events whilst under hypnosis, he claimed to have woken up to the sounds coming from the living room, whilst asleep in the bedroom with Rick and Greg. Investigating these sounds, he saw Sue with two men, one with a moustache and short hair, and the other clean-shaven with long hair. Both wore glasses. According to Justin, John and Dana then entered the home and began heatedly arguing with the men, after which Tina entered the room and was taken out of the cabin's back door by one of the men. Based on Justin's descriptions, composite sketches of the two unknown men were produced by Harlan Embry, who had no training whatsoever in full scenic sketching and no artistic ability. It was never explained why, with access to the Justice Department and Federal Bureau of Investigation's top forensic artists, law enforcement chose to use an amateur who sometimes volunteered to help local police. In press releases accompanying the sketches, the suspects were described as being in their late 20s to early 30s. One stood between 5 foot and 11 inches, that's about 180 centimeters, to 6 feet and 2 inches, which is about 188 centimeters, tall with dark/blonde hair. The other was between 5 feet 6 inches, so 168 centimeters, and 5 feet 10 inches, 178 centimeters. With black hair that was greased back, both wore gold-framed sunglasses. Rumors regarding the crime being ritualistic or motivated by drug trafficking were dismissed by the Plumas County Sheriff, Doug Thomas, who stated in the week following the murders that no drug paraphernalia or illegal drugs were found in the home. Carla McMullen, a family acquaintance, later told detectives that Dana Wingate had recently stolen an unknown quantity of LSD from local drug dealers, though she was unable to provide proof of this claim. About 4,000 man hours were spent working the case, which Thomas described as frustrating. In December of 1983, detectives ruled out serial killers Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole as potential suspects. The house in which the murders occurred was eventually demolished in 2004. In a 2008 documentary on the murders, Marilyn Smart, who claimed that she suspected her husband Martin and his friend John, or Beau Boudet, were responsible for the murders. Marilyn claimed that on the evening of April 11, 1981, she had left Martin and Bob at the local bar around 11 p.m. and returned home to go to sleep. Around 2 a.m. on April 12th, she stated she woke up to find the two men burning an unknown item on the wood stove. Additionally, she alleged that Martin hated Johnny Sharp with a passion. However, in the 2008 documentary, Sheriff Doug Thomas said that he had personally interviewed Martin and that he had passed a polygraph examination. Though I'd take that with a grain of salt, Detective Gamberg said that him and his team found evidence that was never brought forward by the officers or the Department of Justice in earlier investigations of the case, one of which being that anonymous call of the location of Tina's remains. This call wasn't investigated initially, as it was left in evidence for Detective Mike Gamberg to find. Though one thing can be certain is that spanning the investigation, we keep coming back to the same two names popping up. Martin Smart, a neighbour to the Sharps, and his friend, John Beau. Martin Smart initially told investigators that he was missing a hammer. This hammer was located in 2016 in a pond down the road from where Cabin 28 once stood. Investigators believe it was intentionally placed there. Martin Smart fled Kitty after the murders, another red flag. And what may even be more telling is what he wrote in a letter to his then-wife Marilyn. This is the following. I've paid the price of your love, and now I've bought it with four people's lives. Again, evidence would be overlooked, according to Gamberg, who stated that the letter was not taken into account by previous investigators. Gamberg critiqued the quality of the initial investigation, saying that someone fresh out of the academy could have done a better job. It is also alleged that Martin had confessed to his crimes to a counselor he was seeing, but specified that he had nothing to do with the boys. He stated that Tina was killed so that she couldn't identify him, as she had witnessed the whole thing. Unfortunately, Martin Smart died in 2006 of cancer, and John died in 1988. But there could be others involved. But as of 2018, Detective Gamberg stated that DNA evidence recovered from a piece of tape has matched that of a living suspect. Hopefully, the Sharp and Wingate family might finally get some justice for their tragic loss. And yeah, that's the story. That's Kitty murders. Holy moly. Man, fucked up.
Holy shit. That's so tragic.
I still can't get my head around it, eh? Like, the fact that you have this anonymous call, you know, yeah, saying that...
Yeah, that anonymous call, but the 3 years to the day sort of thing, I'm like, that's planned, pre-planned.
Yeah, that's suspect as fuck.
Yeah, that's so sad. We've done a lot of really sad, wonderful job, by the way. We've done a lot of really sad stuff today. Like, was there any happy thing that we could have talked about?
I mean, I don't know.
Ghosts are cute sometimes.
I feel like it's kind of fitting. It's like, yeah, it's Halloween. It's spooky. A whole lot of shit. Just, yeah.
Stay safe, mate. Stay away from people who are like mass murderers in general. I really wish there was some sort of test that you could like, you know, apply to somebody. And there's that golden triangle thing, right? Where it's like, I don't know, childhood trauma versus and then a knock on the head, like a severe head injury and something else. Like, so if anyone's ever had severe head injury, they should also be assessed for childhood trauma.
Well, no, didn't they do something? Oh, God, there was like a American football player or something who like, I think he killed his fiance or something. And they attributed it to his like head trauma or something. Like something, so many knocks to the head created like some kind of...
like a detachment from his, like, empathy or, like, reality
not
or
really.
Like
it just did... It did brain damage so that, like, he would get... I actually can't remember the name. But, like, the gist of the documentary was, like, you know, people need to take head trauma seriously because, like, brain damage, you know, has varying effects that we don't know about. And, you know, it could make these people more violent because of where they're getting knocked to the head or that's how it's processed. I don't know. But
yeah, no, but that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, like, they say that happens with brain tumors too. Like, people get a brain tumor and then, they turn into a psychopath. Like, there's, I mean, your whole reality lives in your head, right?
That's so messed up, to think that, like, I mean, I'm sitting here now thinking that I'm a conscious being, but technically I'm not a conscious being. It's the lump of fat and synapses that is in my skull that is the conscious being.
Electricity drives your movements. Like, yeah.
Oh, God. Love that. Love those tangents.
So great. Anyway, the more you know. Thank you so much for being a part of this, everybody.
Thank you, everyone, for being a part of this craziness. We have loved having you along for the ride. It has been so much fun. It is sad that it is coming to an end, but I feel like it is coming to a fitting end, and we are tying things up nicely. And
and we're finishing it off in spooky season, bud, so there's still a bunch of other spooky stuff to go into, like films and other podcasts and YouTube channels.
Yeah, we've still got another creature feature coming out, more good spooky content for you to tie up this October. But yeah, it's not like, I guess, like a proper goodbye, so to speak. Like,
no,
the episodes and stuff will still be up, and, you know, the Instagram page will still be up as well. Though we will not, I guess, be posting to it. But it'll all still be there for you to enjoy and, you know, go back to it when you need it. But, yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate it. And bye.
Bye. Bye.